I taught in my career four basic subjects, French, English, philosophy, and religious studies. And I want to thank David for the reflections about teaching modern languages. I really wish I'd heard all the things he said when I began teaching French about 20 years ago. But what I want to do today is talk a bit about resources for a few minutes, about storytelling. I know that my philosophy classes were transformed when I began to use storytelling in teaching a difficult text like the Theaetetus by Plato. And storytelling can be used in many, many different ways. But it can be used to bring out these aspects of imagination, empathy, concern that David was really honing in upon so brilliantly. And at Reality Bites, which is in the small English ministry, we have got three courses which we have written for anybody who wants to deploy storytelling in the classroom. We have a course which has got the very positive stories, the inspiring stories that we touched on yesterday, called the Reality Bites Story course. You can get that from our website. So please do check out our website. Do check out some of the stories that you can be using in your own lessons. I want to talk today about how we can actually teach philosophy, but don't worry, it's not going to be boring, in a redeemed, I hope, Christian way. And the title of my lecture today is Mole Hobbes, Star Consultant Stephen Bain, Life's a Bitch, So Go and Sell Yourself. Here's a brief summary of my methodology. Of course, there's a lot more to it, but here are some key aspects to how I go about my own teaching. I try to tell stories that inspire and build faith. And I hope that you got some of those stories yesterday. I try to tell stories that re-enchant the world. And thirdly, I try sometimes to write my own parables. And I told you the parable of the provocative electrician who is shining in the darkness. And that's very cheesy, even in Hertfordshire. Also, I try to tell stories that challenge idolatry. And today's lecture is going to focus upon the fourth kind of story. And I think it's the most difficult and challenging kind of story to deploy. But I think living in a very secular culture, it's actually perhaps the most important type of story that we need to be able to unfold. I want to make a few brief comments about religion. Then I want to talk about Thomas Hobbes, a famous English philosopher. And then I want to tell you some stories. But we do have to go through a little bit of kind of theory to get to how we deploy the stories. Paul of Tarsus, as you know, he speaks about religion in these terms. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie, and they worship and serve created things rather than the Creator. Very simple idea. Does this word created things only mean idols? Well, Jesus speaks about idolatry in rather a different way. He speaks about no one can serve two masters, either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Here we have a different type of religious commitment. It's not to an idol standing there, but to money. And in the Bible, this is called mammon. Again, this connection between idolatry and greed is also mentioned by Paul. You can be sure that no greedy person will inherit the kingdom of Christ and of God, for a greedy person is really an idolater. Paul, he says, not serving our Lord Christ, but their own appetites. Romans again. Look at this, their God is their stomach. How odd that the stomach could be a god. Habakkuk, the prophet, he really kind of, I think, gets at something very important in terms of the Bible when he says this: they scoff at kings and princes, but they are deeply guilty men, for their own strength is their God. Here we have the side of power and strength can become a God. So here's a very simple summary of what I'm trying to get at. Our religion concerns what we are relying upon to save us or keep us on top. It's not what we might say we believe, nor even what we might think we believe, but what we are seen to be entrusting ourselves to, what our hearts are clinging to. Now, these false gods can be both personal, but they can also be impersonal. Now, here we have the storyteller. If we just teach scripture in this more abstract way, which we do need to do, and then don't earth it into actual practice, people can often be confused. So in my teaching, I always try to give very concrete and specific illustrations of what this idolatry could be. Now, this is the worship of Molech, where we have this giant statue and people are beating the drums, and quite horribly, they would feed children into the arms of the statue. This gives us some sense as to what the Bible means when it says, don't worship these false gods, worship Yahweh. So we need to give these specific concrete things which are manifested in a specific narrative. So I think it's important that we can be specific, and the story gives us something very specific and very, very fascinating, because people can actually visualize what it was like to do this kind of worship. Again, in other lectures, I like to spend hours talking about rat worship. I only have 30 seconds here. They still worship rats in India. And in fact, there are 20,000 of these rats. And these rats have the very best chef in the city. The chef's job is to make most wonderful food for rats. And here we have a man worshipping rats. Again, I hope you recognize that this is a form of idolatry. And we have now, moving into the modern world, we need to help young people to connect the worship of rats, which is very easy to spot, the worship of Molech, which is also very easy to spot as being a form of idolatry. But here we have a man who worships Pompey, Portsmouth Football Club. I apologize for this being an English football. Can't find an example in Australia, but I'm sure you can. This man, in a fascinating, intriguing way, has changed his name by default from John Westwood to John Anthony Portsmouth Football Club Westwood. And on his chest, it says, "On Portsmouth till I die." And he was interviewed on a program, and he said in the program, "Yeah, my wife's left me. She said it was the other woman." It wasn't the woman, it was the club. He was looking around, his eyes were very furtive, and he said, "Yeah, it's kind of ruined me, but it's my religion." We need to give young people a discernment about the idols that are powerful in the Western world. I see this, and I really love football. But this kind of football idolatry is something we need to help young people to discern what is good about sport and how sport can be twisted. And Cadbury gives us a sense of the goodness of sport, but here we have something that is very, very twisted. Eden has his curtains themed with a Portsmouth Football Club theme. The whole of his house, everything is stamped with this club. And again, my insight is that storytelling is a way in which we give discernment to young people. Storytelling is not the only way, but it's a way in which we can give young people discernment about the idolatry of our Western culture. Just for a few moments, this woman gave my lesson. was transformed teaching Mark's gospel when I taught the Ten Commandments by looking at a woman who, when she died, was worth $100 million. And yet she was so mean that she stank. She was so smelly because she wouldn't ever have hot baths. And telling her story, which I haven't got time to do today, it helps people to actually make this idolatry concrete and specific. Because it's a real woman. And apparently her son once went down a hill on a toboggan and broke his leg, and she noticed this, and she dragged him home and dressed him in the clothes of a pauper, and then took him to the free hospital. And then when she arrived, the director of the hospital noticed that she was Hetty Green, the world's wealthiest woman, and asked her to leave. And when she eventually got this son of hers to a hospital, she had to pay money, of course, his leg had to be amputated. And I told this story to the class. I asked them which of the Ten Commandments had this woman broken. And they just couldn't stop talking. And at the end of the lesson, I walked away and they came up to me and said, "Is it really true?" And we had a wonderful discussion about the Ten Commandments. And it came from this story about a very, very smelly woman. Let's distinguish for a moment between what I call pagan idolatry and secular idolatry. Now let's just talk a little bit about the year 1588. Can anyone tell me what actually happened in, not in Australia, but what happened in Europe in 1588? And you will be getting a washing machine if you get the right answer. Anyone tell me, please? Yeah, it was the Spanish Armada, that's right. Thomas Hobbes, this philosopher I'm going to be very brief in telling you about, was born in 1588, the year when the Spanish sent their Armada up, and Drake and Raleigh sorted them out. Leviathan, I believe, is not only is it a great classic, but it's an incredibly important work to get young people to understand. The way I was taught philosophy was to look at the word if and the 16 different meanings of the word if. And it was incredibly boring. The way I was taught philosophy was a highly trivial form of language analysis. And to be frank with you, I absolutely hated it. But I believe that starting with Thomas Hobbes and then telling stories is a wonderful way of introducing philosophy into the curriculum and really making people think about the world in which we live. Quickly, let's go through some of Thomas Hobbes' quotes. He said in the Leviathan, "The universe is corporeal. All that is real is material, and what is not material is not real." He's saying this back in the 1650s. He wrote this book during the English Civil War. But he's really proclaiming a very materialist and secular view of life. He said this, "Life is but a motion of limbs. For what is the heart but a spring, and the nerves but so many strings, and the joints so many wheels giving motion to the whole body?" We have a statement of a very secular and materialist view. We are merely machines. "Every desire and inclination proceedeth from some cause, and that from another cause, in a continuous chain, whose first link is in the hand of God, the first of all causes, proceed from," look at this, "necessity. So that to him that could see the connections of those causes, the necessity of all men's voluntary actions would appear manifest." What Thomas Hobbes is saying here is that this God creates everything, and everything then follows strictly by necessity. He says this, "There are of knowledge two kinds, whereof one is knowledge of fact, the the other knowledge of the consequences of one affirmation to another. The former is nothing else but sense and memory, and is absolute knowledge. Don't worry if you're getting bored, because I will explain this in a very simple way. This is the most significant thing, I think, in Hobbes. He says this in chapter 10. The value or worth of a man is, as of all other things, his price. I hope you can see the significance of that. As in other things, so in men, not the seller, but the buyer determines the price. For let a man rate himself at the highest value they can, look at this, yet their true value is no more than it is esteemed by others. That's rather disturbing and menacing. He then says, good fortune, if lasting, is honourable, as a sign of the favour of God. Ill fortune and losses dishonourable. Riches are honourable, for they are power. We have there the embryo of what some people call prosperity teaching. But what Hobbes is saying here is very simple. That the rich are somehow blessed and they are honourable, whereas the poor are somehow not being blessed. And it proceeds from this idea of necessity. And famously, and this is his most famous quote, the life of a man is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Here is my summary of Hobbes. I would encourage you, if you love education and want to teach young people the Bible, it's a great thing to teach Hobbes and then to teach the Bible. Because it makes the Bible come alive. This is what Hobbes says. God barely exists. For Hobbes, God is like a shadowy existence. He's the beginning of a quadratic equation. He's the very beginning of all things. He barely exists. It's very deist. But he says the universe is purely physical. Humans are selfish, calculating machines. And that's the view that David was alerting us to, that often, not always, is being communicated in the way we sometimes teach German and French. That was my interpretation of what David was saying. Humans have no free will. Fine, knowledge must focus on physical stuff. Anything else is nonsense. Look at, should be six there. Humans are commodities. Hobbes, to my knowledge, is the first person to connect. We are merely machines to you can buy and sell the people. Because you are merely a commodity. My question is this, have Western people been mugged by Hobbes, the lad from Wiltshire? Hobbes was from Wiltshire, which in my opinion is about 11th in the hierarchy of English counties. Just so you know, there are 48 English counties, and this is my best three. Hertfordshire, Cornwall, Cumbria. Wiltshire is very low down. But this local man, it's all a bit like that. No, we're only here. My name is Tom and Hodge. Now, Hobbes. What I want to say is that Hobbes, of course, it's not only Hobbes, but this particular way of life, this way of thinking, has discipled many people today. Here is a disciple of Thomas Hobbes. Have you heard of him? Very quickly, let's go through some of the things. He says, we are survival machines. The robot vehicles blindly programmed to preserve the selfish molecules known as genes. Very similar to Thomas Hobbes. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is a bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Nothing but blind, what we word it, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares, DNA just is, and we dance to its music. For Thomas Hobbes, God barely exists. Yeah? For Dawkins, God does not exist. Then look at what Dawkins says. How many of you have heard of Fawlty Towers? Can you put your hands up if you're going to get closer? How many of you like Fawlty Towers? Okay, well, we'll teach philosophy through Fawlty Towers. John Cleese is Fawlty. Now, I must say, I have personal involvement in this. When I was 18, I used to have this particular car. It's called an 1100, and I believe it's made by Morris. And like a lot of English cars, it's not very good. So starting the car most days took me several hours, because they're notoriously bad at starting. And in one fantastic episode, please do spend some time marinating in this episode. Basil Fawlty is driving the 1100, it stalls, he starts to speak to the car. Gets very cross and angry and uses a few slightly dodgy words, gets out of the car, walks away, comes back with this wonderful kind of stick, branch, he begins to beat the car. And I think it's a fabulous scene and I would encourage you to watch it. In an article, Richard Dawkins writes about Basil Fawlty. He says this: "Let's all stop beating Basil's car," he says. This is not me, this is Richard Dawkins, who says this. Just please be attentive, because this is very helpful for us. "Why do we not react in the same way to a defective man? Isn't the murderer or the rapist just a machine with a defective component, or a defective upbringing, defective education, defective genes? Why is it that we humans find it almost impossible to accept such conclusions? Why do we vent such visceral hatred on child murderers or on thuggish vandals? Look at this, when we should simply regard them as faulty units that need fixing or replacing. Look at this, but doesn't a truly mechanistic view of the nervous system make nonsense of the very idea of responsibility, whether diminished or not?" Some people are shocked by that, but it's on the web. He has written this and brings out some of the aspects of this worldview. Now, I have a little bit of what I call in Hertfordshire a fragrant nuance. I don't know if you have them over in Australia, but in Hertfordshire we always have them about our persons. Fragrant. I'm not attacking science here. I'm having a pop at a reductionist way of doing science. We can do science in different ways. We can honour the complexity of the world, or we can reduce everything to one of the aspects, or two of the aspects. So I'm not attacking science, but a particular way of doing science. I do hope that's clear. But Thomas Hobbes and Richard Dawkins would get on like a house on fire if they were supping pints down to the local boozer. Now, I don't know if you have this expression in Australia about like a house on fire. Do you say that? Like a house on fire. Is that okay with you? Okay, like a house on fire. Because although there are a few differences, essentially they agree about the heart of what is a human being. Now, another person who I find very powerful is an old Etonian. Do you all know what Eton is? Well, Stephen Bailey, he talks like this. He has this very, very plummy upper-class accent. And he's very, very, very concerned to understand everything he's saying. Because he's a style consultant, and he's a very amusing fellow, but he wrote a book which is basically a popularization of these views of Hobbes and also Dawkins. And in this book, it's called Life's a Pitch, How to Sell Yourself and Your Brilliant Ideas. In this book, it also became a series of newspaper articles. He basically says this: if we are living in a godless and soulless universe, then the only intelligent response, he says, is to sell yourself. What he's saying is this: you are merely a machine, You are only worth the chemicals that make you up. Therefore, you are either a consumer or somebody who is consumed. You are, in short, a commodity. And it's a very simple way of getting at this, is to compare the idea that we are just physical to another Marcos, who famously had 3,000 pairs of shoes. Enjoying material possessions is all that matters. Now, I think a very helpful way of getting at this idea is this leads to what we call various horizons of happiness. And I want to talk us through this. This is how I would open up this idea with a young person. I'm trying to get at the heart of this worldview in a simple and hopefully entertaining way. If you and your friends are just machines that eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you will die. This is our cat. Can you all see her? Her name is Ava, and she goes out every night, and it's 16 pints of lager and 16 packets of crisps. She comes home, and there she's waiting for me to pour her more beer. It gets even worse, her sister. I mean, I'm asking you, what advice can you give me? I'm shocked. I mean, I'm trying to talk to her about the importance of being a responsible, sensitive, caring. No, she won't listen. It's just shocking, isn't it? What cats do today. Now, what I'm doing here is, in terms of narrative, I'm injecting a moment of dissonance and madness into the lesson. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get little Jimmy at the back, who's 14, I'm trying to get that person's attention in a comedic way, because I want them to understand Thomas Hobbes. Ideally, I'd like little Jimmy to go away and read the Leviathan in the original Greek. But the problem with reading Leviathan is it was, of course, in English. So the purpose, listen, of my storytelling is not merely to entertain, let's have a laugh, let's have a future. I want young people to actually sweat over difficult texts. And I think sometimes we have to sweat over a difficult text. Tintin is not a difficult text. I love Tintin. I deeply respect, in particular, Captain Haddock. But sometimes we want our students to sweat, don't we, over a difficult text and to really learn about Hobbes or Plato or whoever it might be. Now, to the best of my knowledge, our cats have never read Hobbes. But here we see this. If physical nature is all there is, that's Hobbes. Do notice, though, that Hobbes does believe in God and he does quote scripture. But he's 99% materialist and 1% Christian. That makes it tricky to read him. If you and your friends are just machines, see the logic of this, then buy anything you like, because everything is a commodity. That's what Thomas Hobbes said. That's what people work out from the basic premise of secularism. His baby, a book called Rethinking Commodification. Notice the barcode on the baby. The idea of the book is, have we made the baby into something you can buy and sell? Look at this, very simply. If this baby is just a machine, then why not buy it? We have no problem buying watches and computers. If materialism is true, then there is nothing wrong with buying living machines. Thomas Hobbes put it very bluntly, your true value is no more than it is esteemed by others. He was writing that back in the 1600s. And in the words of the pub, Everyone's got their price. The number of times I've been in a pub having a few drinks, and somebody will always say, but everyone's got their price. Have you ever heard that expression? Footballers. Constantly you get this spiel about he's worth every penny. He gets £150,000 a week and he's worth it. How dare you say he's not worth it? And then you think about the implications of that. What about the nurse? What about the teacher? Are we merely worth £2.99? Gordon Gekko, one of the great films of Wall Street, says it beautifully. The most valuable commodity I know of is information. It looks like Dracula in that film. It's this idea that everything is merely a commodity. And this idea, I'm not saying Hobbes was the first person to preach this, but he put it very powerfully. This perspective is very powerful in our culture. And as Christians, we need to understand it and engage with it. So how does this materialist way of life impact real people? I think too often philosophy lessons, they remain on a very abstract and rational level. This is one reason why philosophy has become an incredibly unpopular subject, with good reason. When I tell people, if I have the courage to tell people I love philosophy, they'll always say to me, go on, are you going to prove to me that that table exists? It's a joke, that. You philosophers, that's what you do, isn't it? You prove tables. It's a joke, isn't it? Let's look, get serious about how this perspective actually impacts real people. From your country, in 1997, the Australian squash player, Danielle Dragan, wrapped her naked body in cling film and invited photographers to take pictures of her with a for sale sign hung around her neck. Now, I use cling film for my sandwiches, but it doesn't offend you. Here we have an Australian girl who is commodifying herself. She's doing what Hobbes says is true. She's living out that Hobbesian story. Robbie Fowler talks like that, get up there on a path. It is one of the best English accents, the Scouse accent. But he says in his autobiography this, that's the problem with football. It's ruthless. And so are the people involved in it. It says, you are a commodity. And you can be treated in the most awful manner if they think it can help them in the slightest way. You know, Robbie Fowler is a Scouse working class lad, but he's noticed something. He's noticed this idea of everything becomes a commodity. An Italian girl, and I'm not just picking on, you know, Australians and English people. Here's an Italian girl who is a Roman Catholic woman. She claims to be a Roman Catholic. And this woman, Raffaella Fico, attempted to cash in on her virginity and achieve financial stability. She told an Italian magazine, I can't wait to see who's going to pull out the money to have me. She was auctioning her virginity on the internet. And there are stories even of girls who want to be marriage and family therapists who are auctioning their virginity on the internet. And I think we have to understand these stories and help young people to understand what's going on. This is the one I'm talking about. Amazingly, a girl, you can actually go to YouTube, and if you type in her name, you will see a very disturbing 4-minute video of a man who is talking to her about this contract. The irony that she wants to teach marriage and family therapy and she's auctioning her virginity. And my question is this, has she been mugged by Hobbes? Here's the advert. She comes to us here at the Bunny Ranch with a very special gift. Natalie's a virgin and would like to sell this fresh, priceless and rare commodity. You know, just think, what's going on here? My favorite one I found this last month, Tracy Hobb. An American woman has decided that her son is cute enough to be used as a billboard. For a certain fee, $100,000, if you want a year-long contract, she will dress him in logoed clothes. That's her advert. She actually has an advert of her son, and you, if you pay her enough money, she will put the logo on his t-shirt. And she basically said, when I'm taking him places, everyone seems to notice him and notice what he's wearing. They always say he wears the cutest outfits, and I thought, look at this, someone should be paying me to put their logo on him. He gets so much attention. I think that the challenge that David has given us is, when we teach French and when we teach German, are we allowing our students to discern what's going on? How this commodification is shaping so many people's lives today? The most horrible side of this, and I won't bore you with this, is the whole issue of human trafficking. There's a book, a very powerful book called The Natashas, Inside the New Global Sex Trade. And they reckon that the annual profits made from the exploitation of all trafficked people are $31.6 billion. And I think they're rather cheekily very lucrative for the disciples of Thomas Hobbes. Before the arrival of 15,000 UN troops in Cambodia in 1991, there were an estimated 1,000 prostitutes in the capital. Currently, Cambodia's illegal sex trade generates $500 million a year, where less than 55,000 women and children are sex slaves in Cambodia, 35% of which are younger than 18 years of age. Do you see what's going on here? Hobbes, machines, you are a commodity, slavery. The way I was taught philosophy was to keep Hobbes in a very detached, academic way, with no understanding of how these ideas have legs. You see? You're taught this view that some statements are empirical, some are logical. It's left, as it were, in a corner, disconnected from the world in which we live. And as Christian educators, we have to help people see these connections that leads up with these kinds of tragedies. To follow on from what David was saying, this is very powerful in England. The story, a little parable of a teacher who was teaching chemistry, and little Jimmy put his hand up and said, "Sir, why am I studying chemistry?" And the teacher says, "Well, one day you'll probably be a window cleaner and you'll need to know about chemicals. Shut up and get on with the lesson." And that is sometimes how some teachers in England teach. They bring everything back to the economic, everything back to what is useful for you economically. So what's a Christian educational response to this? Well, I think something we have to get through to young people is to understand both the bitterness of idolatry and the joy of obeying God in all of the rich aspects of the creation. Some of you might be familiar with this way of thinking, but I personally have found this very helpful in teaching in my classroom. What we have here is the crocodile. We have a tree, and we have a rock. And these different creatures have many, many aspects. And all of these aspects have been created by God, and they are good. So we have numerical, spatial, movement, physical, biological, sensory, technical, logical, language, social, economic, aesthetic, legal, ethical, and faith. And the task, I believe, of the Christian educator is to help young people to honor the full orbness of reality, that all of these aspects are important and should not be vilified. It's obvious what Hobbes does. Hobbes will go for the physical stuff, but it ends up with making a god of the economic. But I know of Christians who do the same thing with the faith aspect. It's possible to reduce everything to faith. An example of this is my daughter Hannah, who's 18, went to her youth group, and she was very distressed about what's currently happening in Syria. You know what's happening in Syria? Horrible things. And she was distressed. And the person in the youth group said to her, "Why are you unhappy, Hannah?" She's one of the things happening in Syria. No, you shouldn't be unhappy. We'll pray for you. We'll pray for you, and your unhappiness will go away. That's an example of reducing everything to the faith aspect. And that's just as idolatrous as reducing everything to the physical aspect. Now, to put it simply, this is what I want my students to know. Pagan people worship crocodiles in general, rats and trees. Of course, I'm simplifying. But paganism focuses upon the whole creature, the sun, the moon, the stars, the rat. But in secular idolatry, we worship the aspects of the creation. Go back to that. Secular people, by and large, don't worship crocodiles. Have you noticed that? I've never met a secular person who prays to a crocodile. But in secularism, what we do is we turn away from this more primitive pagan worship and we begin to worship the many aspects, or we select one of the aspects and we then devalue the others. And in the case of Hobbes, it really turns on the economic. The reductionism to the physical leads to everything becoming a commodity. Let's go back to the story I told you. Do you remember who this guy is? Do any of you remember which county he comes from? Not Hertfordshire, that's right. He's a Birmingham man. I thought we'd look this book for, you know. What George Cadbury was struggling to do in his factory was to honour, when he played cricket, all these issues. He obeyed God by infusing his workplace with a, what philosophers call, a simultaneous realization of all the norms. Okay. And I think this is a wonderful way of explaining what he was doing that was so wonderful. Instead of just focusing upon the economic, he was concerned for the social aspect and the fun aspect. Instead of just counting the money, he was concerned that his workers should hear prayers and the Bible being read. What Cadbury was doing was honouring all of these rich aspects and not devaluing one or some at the expense of the others. And we haven't got time. A book that I would recommend that you think about studying is a book by an American philosopher called Roy Clauser. And he wrote a book called What is Religion? The Myth of Religious Neutrality. An essay on the hidden role of religious beliefs in theories. And in this book, he really analyzes the heart of religion and he connects it to how secular people often absolutize certain aspects and at the same time vilify other aspects. But we need to be aware of the fact that Christians can also do the same kind of thing. I'm going to call it a day there, but I would just like to finish by saying, I haven't got time to talk about this, is coming back to, this is my central question that I think we need to engage with young people today. Have Western people been mugged by Hobbes? Have we, as it were, followed his way of living, his way of thinking? And if that's true, how can we give young people discernment about this specific form of idolatry? Anyway, I'd like to thank you very much indeed for listening to me.